Mark Kelly's sister, Carol Ann, was murdered during the Troubles in Northern Ireland.
12 years of age. She was shot in the back of the head. She was shot behind her left ear. And there is absolutely no reason in the world that anyone can give any parent or brother or sister as to why their little sister should be murdered on her own street at the front door of her house.
Mark and hundreds more in Northern Ireland may never have closure now under the UK government's so-called legacy bill that grants immunity to IRA volunteers and to British soldiers for historical atrocities there. It's proving a huge test for Anglo-Irish relations too. Amid a chorus of criticism from around the world, the Republic of Ireland is weighing up a human rights case against London for the first time in more than five decades.
Everyone, no matter who was affected, whether you were affected by IRA violence, paramilitary violence, by the state itself, everyone has a right to justice, some kind of justice, and the very least to investigate whatever had happened to their loved ones. I mean, and that's just the basics, Article 2 of the European Convention, you know.
Under the new legislation, if anyone accused of murder gives information to a so-called truth recovery body, they'll escape prosecution. An attempt, many say, by the British government to hide the truth.
There were hundreds of IRA volunteers that went to jail during the conflict. But if we look at, in stark contrast to British soldiers or the paramilitary RUC, not one ever served a full sentence for the killing of civilians during the conflict. In fact, a number of British soldiers were let out early and given medals once they went back into the British Army. So there's a stark contrast between both. This is really about immunity for British soldiers.
The legislation is now going through the House of Lords, where it's not expected to receive any amendments. And after that, it's going to receive royal assent in just a couple of days. But the victims' families say it's not going to deter them in their pursuit for justice.
3,500 people were killed during the conflict between Protestants loyal to British rule and the majority Catholics who wanted to break away from it. 2,500 of those cases remain unresolved, and it's those who have already paid the most who are being asked to pay again. Saeed Pereza, London.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has told European Parliament Foreign and Defence Committee members that Ukraine will join the military alliance.
Ukraine has never been closer to a membership in NATO than now.
Having allegedly provoked Moscow for years, Stoltenberg was accused at the hearing of now turning his sights on Beijing under Washington's direction.
China has not illegally invaded and bombed a sovereign country in over 40 years, while the US and our allies have hardly stopped in the same period, killing millions of civilians, displacing millions more.
NATO's 31 member states have been called on to stop dithering over the question of providing long-range missiles to Ukraine.
They need these ATACMS, the long-range missiles.
Security analysts say Ukraine joining NATO and the country being supplied with long-range missiles are two moves that could trigger nuclear war. We've been asking members of the public if they are concerned.
It's so far-fetched for us as normal citizens, the thought of that, but I think it should be regarded as a possibility.
When you know that only 5 nuclear bombs can like destroy the whole planet, I don't think we're going to get to that point.
As the conflict rages on with no mention of peace negotiations, the European Commission has just cut its Eurozone economic growth forecasts. But commentators point out that wars are very lucrative for some. And in reality, they suggest, the US-led NATO alliance has nothing to gain from peace. NATO is merely justifying its existence. That's the damning assessment of some legislators.
You said that Ukraine is gradually gaining ground. That's not true. Since you were here the last time, Ukraine has lost territory. 500,000 men are dead.
Some lawmakers point out that corruption in Ukraine is still a major problem. Oleksiy Reznikov was recently pushed out of the country's defence ministry. He was considered one of the West's closest allies. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
...24-year-old Chris Carver left behind a fiancée and an unborn child. His family is still engaged in a bitter fight for justice as they consider his death a murder.
Chris was unarmed at the time of his death. It was caused by a single shot fired by a police officer through the windscreen of a car he was driving in South London. Since the tragic day, his family have said multiple times that they truly believe that if Chris had been white, that the police would have responded very differently. And it's quite possible that he'd still be alive today.
On Saturday, supporters joined his family members for a demonstration outside police headquarters and later the British Parliament to maintain pressure on the authorities.
We've got a police force that, in our opinion, is out of control, and they need to be brought to justice. This is a young man that was unarmed. He was chased by the police down a road at 10 o'clock at night. And there is no repercussions for those people that chased him. We stand with the police. We stand with the family when they say that if Chris was white, he wouldn't have been killed. Chris has been chased and he's been killed because he's black.
An officer involved in the incident has been suspended. However, 1 year on, Carver's family have yet to find out if the police gunman will face any criminal charges. A murder investigation is underway, but the family has expressed frustration at the slow progress of the procedure. To this day, no British firearms officer has ever been convicted of murder or manslaughter after firing their weapon on duty in the UK. Activists believe this may be the case to set the precedent, as complaints of racism against the British police continue to grow. Robert Carter, London.
It has been 22 years since the Pentagon and the two World Trade Center buildings were attacked by planes, ushering in a totally unexpected and deeply destructive era of world history. As usual, in big cities and small towns across the United States, 9/11 was remembered with ceremonies and the same propaganda slogans from decades ago.
22 years ago, hatred and terror did not win. It did not destroy America. Freedom and democracy and the very pillars of this great nation continue to endure.
The biggest domestic legacy of the death of 3,000 civilians may be the internal spying, repression, and paranoia which immediately followed and continues today.
We've gone into a permanent emergency state. That's the key. And it began right after 9/11 with the passage of what was called the U.S. Patriot Act. Everything's a crime, everything's an emergency. The SWAT team raids in America, which are crazy, it's where police are dressed in military gear here. They crash through doors in the middle of the night. They've shot children, old men, veterans. It's so far gone, it's going to be very difficult to roll it back.
Washington's unprecedented and digital domestic dragnet would soon be copied by their allies, especially the United Kingdom, France, and the European Union.
All the great dictators said this, is that we need a sleepwalking people. You need to make people afraid. Once they get fearful, it's called the government needs national security. We need to clamp down everybody. We need to arrest people. And we saw a lot of that, by the way, right after 9/11. It's a way to promote hate against everybody in the world. They don't want us to get along. They want us to disagree. And long as we're disagreeing and fighting, they remain in power.
Washington's vengeful response to 9/11 was their declaration of a so-called global war on terrorism. It is now blamed for causing 4.5 million deaths, directly and indirectly, and the displacement of 45 million people. However, there's little domestic discussion regarding the awful impact of Washington's militaristic response on the anniversary of 9/11 or on any other day.
The events of 9/11 transformed our nation and how we view our national security. It also transformed each of us individually in ways that we don't always talk about publicly.
The prisoners of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, the militarization of American society, the mainstreaming of Islamophobia, so many murdered non-American civilians. 22 years after, the list of victims of 9/11 is still growing. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Thank you. option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atan, the host of this program. Sheikh Karimi is the guest speaker to answer my questions for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to your show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, for today's discussion, again, we want to continue our discussion regarding Ra's al-Hussein, the holy head of Imam al-Hussein, alayhi salam. We know that when the holy Imam and his companions were beheaded, you know, they put the heads on the spears all the way from Karbala to the Shamat or the Levant up until the palace of Yazid ibn Muawiyah. This was, first of all, explain for us what was this action at all? I mean, putting the head on the spears. And there are some narrations talking about some miracles, for example, that the head of the Imam on the spears recited the Holy Quran. Naturally and physically, it is not possible. Such a thing is not possible. Was it a miracle or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, that was a custom at that time to put the head on the spears to, show it was a sign of victory over an enemy. And they did that with the holy body of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and some of his companions. So we cannot claim that it was unprecedented, but the point is that we are talking about the grandson of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. There are a number of narrations, both and historical reports, both in Shia and Sunni sources, referring to some miracles which happened after the tragedy of Karbala. So for today's session, we are just talking about the miracle related to the holy head of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and the fact that this head, which is separated from the body on a spear, it has recited some verses of the Quran. We can claim that it can be proved from both Shia and Sunni sources. For example, Sheikh Al-Mufid, rahmatullah alayhi, in his great book, Al-Irshad, he says that, عن زيد بن أرقم أنه قال, he narrates from زيد بن أرقم about the fact that a person says that I was in a place where I saw the holy head of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on the spear, and then suddenly I heard that head reciting the verse from chapter Al-Kahf, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم أم حسبت أن أصحاب الكهف والرقيم كانوا من آياتنا عجبا. Then that person sees the head and he comes to know that this is the head of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. He says, رَأْسُكَ وَاللَّهِ يَبْنَ رَسُولَ اللَّهِ أَعْجَبْ وَأَعْجَبْ. So the verse is talking about the people of the cave, Kahf, and that they were surprised by witnessing divine signs. And the person witnessing Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam reciting the Quran on the spear, he says, رَأْسُكَ وَاللَّهِ أَعْجَبْ وَأَعْجَبْ. More surprising that those signs mentioned in this verse is to see your head on this pier. This is in Al-Ishad by Sheikh Al-Mufid, volume 2, page 117. Muhammad bin Sulaiman al-Kufi, in his Manaqib al-Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen, alayhi salam, volume 2, page 267, he also says that the narration is from Minhal ibn Amr. He says, رَأَيْتُ رَأْسَ الْحُسَيْنِ ابْنَ عَلِي عَلَى الرَّمْحِ, I saw the holy head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam on this spear. وَهُوَ يَتْلُو هَذَهِ الْآيَةِ, he was reciting this verse, again the same verse, chapter Kahf, verse 18. And أَمْ حَسَبْتَ أَنَّ أَصْحَابَ الْكَهْفِ وَالرَّقِيمِ كَانُوا مِنْ آيَاتِنَا عَجَبًا. And one of the people in that place, he says that رَأْسُكَ يَبْنَ رَسُولَ اللَّهِ أَعْجَبَ, more surprising is to see your head, O son of the Prophet.
Yes.
Ibn Hamda al-Tusi, in his Al-Thaqib fil Manaqib, he has also referred to two historical reports. One of them, again, from Minhal ibn Am. He swears by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, أَنَا وَاللَّهِ رَأَيْتُ رَأْسَ الْحُسَيْنِ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ عَلَىٰ قَنَاتِ, I swear by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that I saw the head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam on the spear, and he was reciting the Quran from chapter Kahf. And again, we have Qutbuddin Rawandi, another great Shia scholar, in Al-Khara'ij wal-Jara'ih, volume 2, page 577. He also narrates that person. He says that رَأَيْتُ رَأْسَ الْحُسَيْنِ حِينَ حُمِلَ وَأَنَا بِدِمَاشْقِ, I was in the city of Damascus, and I saw the holy head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam on this spear, and he was reciting the verse. The same had been mentioned by some other Shia scholars, for example, Ibn Shahr Ashub in Manaqib Ala Abi Talib, volume 3, page 218. And Ali ibn Yunus Amali in As-Sirat al-Mustaqim, volume 2, page 179. Sayyid Hashim Bahrani in Madinat al-Ma'ajiz, chapter 4, verse volume 4, page 123. And in his Biharul Anwar Allama Majlisi has dedicated a chapter for this event in volume 45. Page 121. So these are some of the Shia scholars. Among the Sunni scholars, we have some references. For example, Ibn Asakir in his famous book, Tarikh Madinat Dimashq, the history of the city of Damascus, he says that he quotes from another person. It's not Minhal ibn Am, but he says that Ra'aytu Ra's al-Husayn ibn Ali radiallahu anhuma ala al-Qanat. I saw the head of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on the spear. وَهُوَ يَقُولُ, in this narration in Tariq Madinatu Damascus, we have a different verse. فَسَيَكْفِيكَهُمُ اللَّهُ وَهُوَ السَّمِيعُ الْعَلِيمُ, which means that it might be two events. One of them, recitation of that verse in chapter Al-Kahf, witnessed by Minhal ibn Amr, and another event in which another verse, فَسَيَكْفِيكَهُمُ اللَّهُ وَهُوَ السَّمِيعُ الْعَلِيمُ. And of course, this is in Tariq Madinat Damascus, volume 22, page 117.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to English Radio at irib.ir. Praises to Allah, all glory is to Allah.
We worship Allah and no one but Allah. In the same book, Ibn Asakir, in another place, he refers to the story and the narration of Minhal ibn Amr. He says, أَنَا وَاللَّهُ رَأَيْتُ رَأْسَ الْحُسَيْنِ ابْنَ عَلِيَ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ حِينَ حُمِلْ وَأَنَا بِدَمَاشْقِ, I swear by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that when the head of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was taken to Damascus, I saw him reciting the verse, أَمْ حَسِبْتَ أَنَّ أَصْحَابَ الْكَهْفِ وَالرَّقِيمِ كَانُوا مِنْ آيَاتِنَا Ajaba. This is in Tarikh al-Madinat Dimashq.
So the verse was also indicated by the historians.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in the Shia and Sunni sources, we have a number of, as I mentioned, Shia scholars and Sunni scholars referring to the fact that Imam Hussein alayhi salam's head has recited the Quran. According to some narrations, he recited the verse from chapter Kaf. According to another report, he recited the verse فَسَيَكْفِيكَهُمُ اللَّهِ وَهُوَ السَّمِيعُ الْعَلِيمُ. So it seems that it is a matter of certainty that the holy head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam has recited some verses of the Noble Book of Quran on the spear.
That's right. The head of Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas was also on the spear, along with Imam al-Hussein to Shamat.
Yes, it was, but I mean, the details are not mentioned. The main details which are mentioned by the narrations are about the head of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. For example, we know that how it was taken from Karbala to Kufa, and what happened on the way. For example, according to some reports, it was taken by Khuli for one night, and so on and so forth, because the main
in the house of Khuli.
So all the reports that we have are related to the holy head of Imam Hussein.
But for sure we know that Rasul Hussein was shown to Yazid, isn't it?
Sure.
So is it true that there was some disrespect to the, for example, the Rasul Hussein in the palace of Yazid on that
according
time?
To historical reports, both in Shia and Sunni sources, especially in Shia sources, the holy head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam was disrespected by different people, including Yazid.
If this really happened and there were so eyewitness to that, so why enmity with Ahlul Bayt and Imam al-Hussein and the captives of the Ahlul Bayt on that time?
There are different answers that can be given to this question. So the question might be that, so the head of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is reciting a verse. And of course, this is supernatural. I mean, it's a miracle. Imagine holy head on a spear, it is reciting the Quran. It's giving a message to the people that he is with the truth, because he is reciting the Noble Book of Quran in a very supernatural way. So why people did not come to know the reality? There are different answers. First of all, it might have been witnessed by few people, not all the people. That is a possibility, because mainly in the narrations we have Minhal ibn Amr and another person. So one possibility is that when it happened, it was not, possible for all the people to witness that. And the second answer to this point, to this question, is that maybe this event was not a physical event. I mean that sometimes some issues, some events happen in another realm, and only few people are able to witness that in a malakuti, in a mithali realm. Of course, this is just a possibility. But the main answer to this question is that, before referring to the main answer, the third point is that some people, when they came to know that this is Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, they regretted their actions. We have in the history of the tragedy of Karbala that, especially people of Sham, Damascus, they thought that these people are, disbelievers, they are Khawarij, because they are enemies to Yazid. But at least few of them, when they came to know that this is Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, this is Imam al-Sajjad, this is Lady Zainab salamullahi alayha, they came to know about the reality, and they changed their viewpoint. But the main answer to this question is that this is not something new. I mean, in the history of humankind, people have witnessed so many miracles performed by the prophets and the Imams of the Ahl Bayt, but they were not ready to believe in the prophets and the Imams.
Yes.
If you go back, imagine at the time of Prophet Salih alayhi salam and that she-camel.
Yes.
So it is absolutely supernatural to see a she-camel coming from nowhere. So it's a big miracle. But the majority of the people do not believe in him. At the time of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, he is set into the fire, but the whole fire turns into a garden.
Yes.
Okay?
A flower garden, that's right.
It's still, the majority of the people witnessing that, they are not ready to believe in him. And it comes to the time of Prophet Musa alayhi salam. We know that different miracles were performed by Musa alayhi salam. Musa alayhi salam performed that miracle, and the magician themselves, they come to believe in Musa alayhi salam. But the people belonging to Fir'aun, they are not ready to believe in him.
That's right.
The same is true about Prophet Isa alayhi salam. He, also, according to the Quran, he revived the dead people.
Yes.
He healed...
Talking in cradle.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the same is true about our Prophet, peace be upon him, and yes. his family showing different miracles. The Quran is only one of them.
Imam Ali alayhi salam being born in Kaaba.
Exactly.
Okay, as a sign. As
and
a sign, that's right.
So... It's not the case that people just witnessing a miracle, they are ready to believe in truth. Unfortunately, Satan is there to deceive
yes.
the people.
Okay.
I mean, our carnal desires are there. So my point is that it's not something new. In the history of humankind, up until today, when we have the living miracle among the people, the Holy Noble Book of Quran, we see people, instead of believing in Quran, they try to burn the Quran.
Yes.
So that is rooted in satanic and the vain desires of the people.
That's right. Thank you very much, Sheikh. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min labani Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في
This one lay.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's supposed to be an agency void of politicization, but the IAEA has shown once again it is susceptible to that. Another Western-sponsored anti-Iran statement has been issued during the IAEA's Board of Governors meeting, despite the cooperation between the agency and Iran, and despite Iran and the IAEA having made considerable progress in boosting cooperation based on a joint statement that was issued back in March. Well, Iran has slammed the statement and said that it will answer this in due time. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why Iran's civilian nuclear file and program and its cooperation is undermined by the U.S. and Europe, with the aim of reaching their own political objectives. Let me introduce our guest first. John Busnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, joins us from Belgrade. Also joining us, Ishak Krishnathwamy, who is a journalist and podcaster, joining us from Addison. Welcome to you both. John Busnich, I'll first start with you. Taking a look at what has occurred here, we're looking at a statement that was issued by the U.S. and its three European allies, namely France, Germany, and the U.K. But the tone was more of a threatening one. It was a threat. basically saying that another resolution of the UN Nuclear Watchdogs Board may be issued if you don't explain uranium traces, as I'm reading off here, at undeclared sites. But at the same time, they've left open whether or not they're going to perhaps follow through with that. They may and they may not. So they're playing up with words there, which we're going to get into in a minute. But what do you think of the threatening tone used in this statement that was issued by the U.S. and the three European allies against Iran?
Well, this is just par for the course. We've been seeing this go on for years now. The United States purports to speak in the name of the international community, and it has its lackeys, England, Germany, and France, usually chirping in behind. The fact is that the IAEA is an international body that is not answerable to the United States or to any individual country. It has its board of directors, it is an international organization, it has its inspectors, and the inspectors are working directly with Iran to certify the standards compliance. It is not a place for the international intervention by the United States in any way, shape, or form. America is once again playing the global bully and pretending to play the global policeman.
Well, I do have to ask this because it's a natural and logical question that's been asked maybe more than 10,000 times. And that is the fact that when you have the U.S. who pulled out of the agreement, and then you had Europe who did not follow through with the promises that they made after the U.S. pullout, no matter what and how you look at the different approaches, which will all did not pan out to be anything, how could they expect Iran to have pursued the cooperation that it did? I mean, they were the ones who were at fault here, basically.
Of course, when you sign a treaty and you show that you cannot withstand or hold to a treaty longer than an administration, and it's going to be always be at the whims of whoever is the president, it means that you cannot rely on the country's treaties at all. And there is no reason why any country should abide by treaties signed with America, because it is impossible for any new administration to hijack this. So there's no reason. And on top of it, of course, Iran did it because Iran back then was under severe, severe sanctions. And in exchange for some sanction relief, this seemed like a good deal. In fact, Iran has a fatwa that was signed in 1989 with Ayatollah Khomeini, who has banned, who has called nuclear weapons un-Islamic. So we know Iran's never going to build any nuclear weapons. So the uranium will only be used for fuel and other resources that people ever all over the world use. But again, this treaty, in an attempt to change their colors, is once again like an attempt to try to impose more sanctions on Iran and try to use their standard bullying tactic to get Iran to comply, even though there is no guarantees of anything for Iran.
There has been reference to this March statement. I have to mention that for people who are not familiar with it, of which the joint statement included, John Busnich, quote, regarding the outstanding safeguards issues related to the three locations, Iran expressed its readiness to continue its cooperation and to provide further information and access to address the outstanding safeguard issues, where it expressed its readiness to allow the IAEA to implement further appropriate verification and monitoring activities. The Iran has continued its cooperation with the IAEA in one form or another. Now, what's curious about all this is that why would the U.S. and Europe issue a statement when there is actually a two-way communication and cooperation that are happening here with an oversight that involves oversight? Does the U.S. or Europe want Iran not to continue this cooperation with these types of threatening statements?
Well, I think that this is a case of the United States and the European allies being pulled by the nose by Israel, which has always been playing a behind-the-curtain role against Iran in this whole matter. We've got pressure on the United States from Israel. Israel is a major military and economic partner of the United States, and Israel is the country that wants to neutralize Iran. And when I say neutralize, I mean destroy. And we know this for a long time. Now, we've got the United States trying to pretend that it's adhering to international law, but they're not. They are directly interfering in the independent work of the IAEA. The United States has this method of operandus all over the world. They signed the Rambouillet Accords with Serbia in 1999 and then proceeded to bomb. Then they canceled the Rambouillet Agreement and they tried to enforce it on Serbia unilaterally. They did that here now with Iran. They enter into a deal, then they cancel the deal, but they expect you to comply with the deal. They will not fulfill their half of the contract, but you are held to the letter of the contract. And what's the most amazing in this case is that Iran is actually continuing to comply. Iran is continuing to allow inspections, and the United States does not in any way address these issues. This is the manner of a thug. Not anything to do with international law nor international standards, and it only goes to demonstrate once again that Germany, England, and France, and all other countries that put their little X behind the U.S. signature are nothing more than occupied military and economic colonies. This is not the way the world will be run. This is not a multinational, multilateral world. This is a U.S. dictatorship, and Iran is absolutely right to refuse to be dictated to be refusing to be lied to, and to be refusing to be cornered when it is the only complying partner in the deal.
Well, when Israel comes into the picture, Isha, it's got to be mentioned how that is just filled with double standards. But honestly, when you take a look at the fact that you have this Israeli regime, it's not a member of the NPT. It doesn't allow the IAEA to inspect its facilities. We know that it has anywhere between 200 to 400 nuclear warheads. And worse yet, and really on a dangerous level, they are actively attacking another country, Syria, on a weekly basis. They have threatened Iran militarily on a number of occasions. They have killed Iranian, or I should say assassinated Iranian scientists. They have even sabotaged Iran's nuclear facilities. Shouldn't that be dangerous? Shouldn't that spell an alarm bell or ring an alarm bell for the international community as a whole that, you have nuclear-armed Israel with the preceding actions that I just mentioned, that they should open the doors and be open to minimum inspections. But yet Israel is saying that Iran is the one that's the danger.
Of course, Israel should be monitored in a much more serious fashion. I have interviewed authors who have gone to weapons shows in Israel where they literally advertise Palestine as testing grounds for their weapons so they can be sold. And on top of it, they have a no, like most countries with nukes have a no first strike policy. That means we will not use. Not so much. And on top of it, let's not forget, they're also incurring on Lebanon too, almost on a weekly or a monthly basis. So they are definitely a threat. And they are likely to, when cornered, it is very likely that Israel will use nuclear weapons as a last-ditch effort as opposed to surrendering. So it is definitely something that the world community should consider, but of course they don't, and we know why. U.S. and U.K. are the only ones who consistently veto any Security Council measures against Israel in the UN Security Council, and they're permanent members. So as long as the UN exists the way it is, Israel will more or less be accountability proof.
Agencies and even U.S. officials have time and again mentioned, John Busnich, that Iran is not pursuing a nuclear weapon. I'm taking a look at the most recent one back in May, where you had let me see exactly who it was, the U.S. intelligence agency's overall quote, Iran is not undertaking the key nuclear weapons development activities that would be necessary to produce a testable nuclear device. I can go back to the year 2006. National Intelligence Director back then, John Negroponte, I don't know if you remember him, said that the U.S. believes that Tehran probably does not yet have a nuclear weapon. You have many agencies and officials from the U.S. that have said that Iran is not after it, even though you have things like this statement come out where the use of threat was announced by the U.S. and the three European partners. If the security agencies are saying that Iran is not after a nuclear weapon, then why is it that the U.S. Itself is pursuing this avenue along with the Europeans?
As I said before, this is a tail wagging the dog here. Israel is wagging the American dog. Israel is pressuring America to play an aggressive militarist role against Iran in the interests of Israel. And this is not a new thing. This is not a revelation. This is admitted in Israeli politics. This is discussed in Israeli media. It doesn't take a nuclear scientist to figure out that if you read it in the national newspapers of Israel, that this is their policy, then this is actually their policy. I don't understand how the people of the West, with the global internet, with the access to information that now...
political motive behind every action. That's just the way it is. As for the U.S.'s exorbitant influence, of course, the U.S.'s exorbitant influence plays a huge part, especially in the budgeting. And also, let's look at who the directors and who they select. And you'll see a large portion of them come from either the U.S. or the European Union countries. And that itself biases their perspective. So this is definitely any agency within the UN, you'll see the double standard hypocrisy because it also has a different political agenda from the one that they openly claim they have.
So you have all these threats coming out, well, not all these threats, but the most recent threat that has been issued by the U.S. and its European allies, three countries, John Busnich. And then you have the announcements that have been made in the past week or so, maybe a little bit longer, about how the U.S. and Iran have reached an agreement based on two issues. One is the one on the humanitarian grounds, as Iran calls it, which involves the exchange of prisoners. And the other one, you have the release of Iranian frozen funds, which was from South Korea to Qatar, which is both are still in the completion process. What do you make of that when that announcement comes out? I mean, if I'm from the outside looking in and I'm looking through the U.S. Point of view, I don't think the U.S. would go ahead with this if it thought that Iran was after weaponization of its nuclear program. I mean, isn't that a proof right there that the U.S. knows that it's not after it?
Correct. That's obviously correct. What this means is that there's a little bit of a disagreement between Israel and the United States. The United States is minimally complying with their agreements. That means minimally. They are delaying. They are minimizing the effect. They are trying to punish Iran. I do not know what for, except for not being a military colony of the United States, if that's what their desire was. But in fact, there is minimal compliance by the United States because they simply cannot deny the fact that, in general, according to the agreement and according to the IAEA rules, Iran is complying. And the United States simply cannot avoid admitting some part of that. And what we're seeing now is clawback on the part of Israel, which is trying to pressure not just the United States, but individual states as members of the IAEA to sign a declaration that contradicts the findings of their own inspectors. This is absurdity. And this is where Iran has to stand up for itself, and it has to say, either there's an international organization and it has certified inspectors and they give inspection results and we honor them, or there isn't. And if there isn't, then we have to do away with this entire facade and we have to treat everybody as equals and we have to say, how is it that Israel can be a non-declared military nuclear power in this same region at the same time as it attempts every dirty trick in the book to stop Iran from having a domestic power production system using nuclear power like dozens of countries around the world?
We have had the Iranian president also make some statements recently, Yasha, and one of them is the fact that in an interview, the Iranian president said and underscored the need to use civilian nuclear energy when it comes to industry, when it comes to agriculture, and when it comes to medicine in order to improve people's welfare. I mean, it's very obvious that Iran is not going to back down from its civilian nuclear program if that's what the U.S. thinks Iran is going to do, or should I say Israel. These are obviously different things that Iran could use this program for, the civilian nuclear program. Am I incorrect to say that they want Iran to abandon completely its civilian nuclear program, something that Iran is not going to do?
Yeah, of course, the U.S. and its allies have always been anti-development, even with the World Bank, where they pretend that they want to help develop third world countries. None of these countries ever get developed. They just blow deeper and deeper into debt, and there's no infrastructure, nothing ever happens. And so fundamentally, that is the U.S. business model of imperialism, is that they need to sell their cheap goods or cheap finances nowadays into extremely underdeveloped countries with the very bad deals that they kind of have to agree to due to sheer poverty or desperation. And Iran does, I mean, U.S. does not like in negotiating with equals, and they don't even understand it, as it can be seen with their feeble attempts of negotiating with Russia, that they are just not capable of fathoming how to negotiate with equals who don't capitulate due to their sheer threats. So, U.S. in general does not like any kind of development. And in particular with Iran, they don't like it because that means Iran will be the regional power. There are many countries around Iran that are much more underdeveloped, Afghanistan, Pakistan, just you name it. And if Iran starts being the center of commerce for them, of course, they will not be able to influence the government, put in whoever they want, like the Al-Qaeda or whatever they arm, and create terrorism and chaos in these in this region. And it will definitely make it harder for them to treat the world as a global chessboard. So they are absolutely against any kind of development with Iran, and especially nuclear development, because it has so much potential for giving energy, fuel, and that is what all these other countries need the most in order to build infrastructure for themselves so that they can start producing the higher valued materials as opposed to just exporting raw materials to the West.
Thank you very much. We're going to leave it there. We're fresh out of time. Dazesha Krishnaswamy, journalist and broadcaster from Madison. Thank you. John Busnish, journalist, activist, and political analyst from Belgrade. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vatavai and the team, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.